I'm going to begin our study this morning by asking you to do something that C.S. Lewis suggested that believers ought to do when they think about the subject matter which we have been contemplating now for the past 3 weeks as a part of our study to the prologue to the Gospel of John. And specifically, we have been looking at the matter of the incarnation of the Word. John 1:14, which is, we've progressed this far in the prologue, reads, "In the Word was made flesh, and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." He says, the Word became flesh. In those few words, we find one of the great mysteries of Scripture. These words, the Word became flesh, set forth to become the basis, the foundation, if you will, for the doctrine of the hypostatic union. When you come to the incarnation of Jesus Christ, there are many things one can focus upon and deal with. One of the aspects, and I think one of the most significant aspects of the incarnation of Jesus Christ, and one of the most mysterious of the aspects of the incarnation of the Word, is the reality of the hypostatic union, which simply put is the teaching two natures, the divine nature and the human nature, are united in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ forever. Forever. Now, C.S. Lewis suggested this as one thinks about these two natures. When you think about the divine nature, the human nature being in the person of Jesus Christ forever, here's what he said we ought maybe to contemplate. I assume most of you are familiar with Clive. If C.S. stands for Clive, I can see why he went by C.S. But Clive, Staples, Lewis. C.S. Lewis, born in 1898, my daughter, November 29th, day after Renee's birthday. Not 1898, obviously, for my daughter. He went home to be with the Lord. It's been a while, back in 1963. But C.S. Lewis is a British novelist. He's a poet, an academic, medievalist, a literary critic, an essayist, a lay theologian, and a very good one, a broadcaster, a lecturer, a Christian apologist, a very well-educated man, scholarly man. He held academic positions simultaneously both at Oxford University in Magdalen College from 1925 to 1954. And then from 1954 through 1963, he held seats at Cambridge University, Magdalen College. Most of you probably know him, if you know him at all, from his work like the Screwtape Letters or the Chronicles of Narnia. That is probably the most famous work here in the United States. But he also has nonfiction works, Mere Christianity. That's perhaps why I first met him, I think. His book on miracles. He has another book, a work called The Problem of Pain. But he is a well-known author. But here's what he suggested. He said, here's what we ought to think about when you think about the incarnation, when you think about the hypostatic union. Think about this. Lying at your feet is your dog. Imagine for the moment that your dog is in deep distress. Now, some of us loves dogs very much. If it would help all the dogs in the world to become like men, would you be willing to become a dog? Would you put down your human nature, leave your loved ones, your job, your hobbies, your art, your literature and music, and choose instead of the intimate communion with your beloved the poor substitute of looking into the beloved's face and wagging your tail, unable to smile or to speak. Would you be willing to do that? Do it knowing this, that you're going to die a horrifying death, that you're going to be attacked by a pack of dogs and is shredded to pieces and die. Would you be willing to set aside all of the prerogatives, all of the privileges that you have as a human being, become a dog, to live like a dog? And my dogs live well. I mean, they really do. But I really want to eat every day of my life, twice a day, the same boring food. But I want my world to be limited to 2,500 or so square feet in the downstairs of my home. That's it. Well, occasionally I get to go out the back for a couple of minutes. In the highlight of my life to be in the morning when I get a little piece of carrot. This is what I've got to look forward to. And my dogs have it good. Would you be willing to do that? Well, that's what the Word did when He became flesh. He took a far greater step down. Far greater step down for Him, for the eternal Word to become flesh, than it would be for me to become a dog. The chasm is so wide I can't begin how to bridge it. But when the Word took upon Himself a human nature in the person of Jesus Christ forever, when He who was fully God became fully man to Himself. So what we're talking about when we talk about the doctrine of the hypostatic union, we're talking about one who is in every sense and every way the very God of very God becoming a man forever. Now, for the last 3 weeks, it's worth thinking about. Now, for the last 3 weeks, we have been looking at this truth that Jesus is fully God and that Jesus is fully man as the reality. Now, put it under this perspective, I've got several R's I'm looking at relative to John 1:14, the Word becoming flesh, and the hypostatic union, the reality of the hypostatic union. And I've given you five proofs of the reality. And this morning and then next Sunday, I'm going to finish the sixth and final proof of the reality of the hypostatic union. And I still have two more things to do with that. And one is, how did that become a reality? And two, why did He undertake human flesh and blood and become a man? Sixth, the sixth reality. The reality of the hypostatic union is attested to in really pretty straightforward language in the Greek text, not so much in the English, but pretty much straightforward attested to by a command that has been given to believers at Philippi in that we find recorded in the book of Philippians chapter 2 verses 5 through 11. Last Sunday we took a little bit of time to point out, and I'm going to do it again this Sunday. To me, one of the things that I marveled at this, I see this intense doctrinal teaching concerning the hypostatic union set forth right in the midst of a practical problem. The problem was, you have these two ladies who, for whatever reason, were jockeying for position in the church. They were fighting back and forth for that position. And the Apostle Paul, in Philippians chapter 2, at verse 5, gives this command to these believers. And the command is to let this mind be in you, mind or thinking as we looked at last week, which was also in Christ Jesus. That's the command. And the command is to have the mental attitude, as we will see as you unfold verses 6, 7, 8, and that's as far as I'm going to go in that context. But you'll see that the command is to have the same kind of humility that the person of Jesus Christ possessed in his pre-incarnate state as the Word, and that he manifested in his post-incarnate state as Jesus Christ in the flesh. We read in Philippians 2:5 this: let this mind, or we saw last week for now, thinking, or let this mental attitude, or might be a better way to put this, let this mindset be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery, thought it not a thing to be grasped, thought it not a thing to be clinged on to, held on to be equal with God. Now we're going to take this verse apart this morning, and with clarity, this verse teaches in his pre-incarnate state that Jesus Christ is God, that he possesses all of the attributes, nature, prerogatives, position as God, because that's who he is. And then in verse 7, but made himself of no reputation, took upon himself the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And then in verse 8, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, became obedient to death, even the death of the cross. Verses 7 and 8 show us very clearly the humanity of the person of Jesus Christ. And so I see in verse 6 his eternal deity, then I see in verses 7 and 8 his humanity, and I see the two are together, which is exactly what the hypostatic union teaches. So we're going to start here with verse 6 in the pre-incarnate state of Jesus Christ. Absolute deity. Absolute deity. That's how he existed for all eternity prior to the Word becoming flesh. How did he exist? As absolute deity. Again, verse 6 reads, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. This is one of those verses, well, quite frankly, almost every single word needs to be looked at closely. It needs to be contemplated, and we need to come to what is a proper understanding of the words that are used. And why did he use this word for being? So I know what the Greek word he used for, it's hyparko, and not eimi. And what about form? He's only in the form of God? What do you mean it's not robbery? What do these words mean? So one by one, we'll look at two. I'm going to look at each one of these words. The word being, the word existed, the word was. It's a present participle of the verbal hyparko. And all of that has meaning. And all that communicates something about the person of Jesus Christ before the Word became flesh. Or the word form. Or if you're looking, and as a wow, from form to very nature. Well, that's a big leap in translation differences. This translation comes from the New Revised Standard. Well, how do they get the very nature and the others get the form? How do you explain the word morphe as it sits in this context? Or thought, considered, regard, hegomai. It's the aorist tense form of the verbal hegomai. That tells me a whole lot about the mindset. We sang the song, let this mind be in you. This reveals the kind of mindset that the Word had prior to the incarnation. Or robbery, thing to be grasped, to be exploited. These are all translations. Here's King James. Here's what the New American Standard, New Revised Standard do, things to be grasped. NIV says to be exploited. Hapargmon. These are all these things are very different in their sense. What sense is right? And then how do you explain the sense in the context of the passage? Or, what do you mean by equal? Or equality? Hissa. Every one of those words really deserve attention. And every one of them need to be explained. They need to be defined. If not, then we really don't understand what's being said at all in the passage. No, the Lord has chosen words as His means to communicate. And those are the God-breathed words that He used to express the pre-incarnate, something about the pre-incarnate state of the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we're going to look at these one by one, almost, and see what He's trying to communicate. Who being, or who existed? It's a translation of the phrase you see up there. This is the relative particle who. And this is the word huparkon, translated being, or translated existed, or translated was. The simple thing first, who, being the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. The word who refers to Jesus Christ. That's who he's talking about in verse 5. So he's looking at Jesus Christ. He says, who being. Now I asked the questions, and I wouldn't expect you to ask the question, but I answered. I asked, well, why did you use huparko? Why didn't you use the far more common state of being verb eimi? That's by far, when you see the words are, was, to be, is, it's the Greek verb eimi. Huparko, certainly it's any one of those translations I think are acceptable translations, but why that particular verbal, why not eimi? And here is why. There is a reason. Who, that is Jesus Christ, although being. Now I added the words although because the word huparko, and I said it's a participle flying by it. Well, I think it's a concessive participle, and that's why I've added the words although. The purpose of the concessive participle is to express that something is existing in this case, or something is happening in spite of what is being stated. So who, Jesus, although being in the form of God, he, that is Jesus, did not think it robbery, he did not think a thing to be grasped, to be equal with God. Well, here's what huparko does. Well, didn't I put it back up that way? I don't need to be those again. Yeah. Who, that is Jesus Christ, and you can take, I don't care which translation you use, other than I want you to use was. Okay? I don't want you to use was because was is a past tense verbal. The word huparkon is a present participle. Okay, the present participle denotes a continuing, ongoing state, in this case, of being. Huparko does something that eimi does not. It will emphasize the reality. It puts added stress to the reality of the state of being or to the state of existence. And so, if he used eimi, the answer is he really did. But here he's saying, no, he really, really did. Okay? He doesn't want us to slide by this and miss the absolute reality of the truth that is being communicated. I'm not going to look all these passages up that I have, but each of these verses that you see here on the slide or on your note sheets, those verses use huparko. And if you look at them, I'm going to look at two. I think you'll be able to see, okay, he's trying to stress that this really is the state of being. That's why he uses this verbal, not another one. Here is how huparko is defined by a Greek English lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature. One, the number one definition, to really be there, to really exist. So it's not just exist, he really exists. Here's another lexicon. This is a word study dictionary. This is how they define huparko. Generally, in an absolute sense, to exist. Okay? No ifs, no ands, no buts. He really, truly exist in the fashion as described in Philippians 2:6. Here's one of the two examples. I said I would show you the word, and maybe you can understand. I'll be able to share from this passage. Okay, here's why he uses huparko, because he wants you to understand what he's talking about. This is really, really the state of being for this man. Luke 16:23 says, and in Hades, he, that is the rich man who Lazarus the beggar sat at his gate and begged. This rich man had now died. He lifted up his eyes, being huparko, not ami, being in torments. Why did he use huparko? Because he is trying to express to us this is really the state of being for this man. And by the way, this is not a parable in Luke 16. I know some teach it that way. There are several reasons why you don't see it as a parable. The number one being, in all of the other parables of Jesus, without exception, he never mentions a person by name. Never. What about the parable of prodigal son? What's his name? What's his father's name? Don't know. It's a parable. This is not a parable. That's why you have Lazarus mentioned by name. This is something that really, truly took place. And to underscore the reality of this state of being, he uses huparko. And in Hades, he lifted up his eyes, really, truly, for a fact, being in torments. And seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. That's huparko. Here's one other one. And the others you can look up on your own. In this given context, this huparko is used. And I think it is used because the two men, it was incredible to stand there. I should just put the picture up because I still have it. I stood at Philippi, right in the place where Paul and Silas were brought. It's a way that when they excavated the town, it was very simple to know where this place was. But what had happened in the context, Paul, Silas, had been used by the Lord to cast out this demon that had possessed this young woman that made it possible for her to pretty accurately foretell the future. And that made the two men who owned her a bunch of money. They were making money hand over fist with that spirit of divination. All of a sudden, the spirit's gone, cast out. Profits, boom, this way. They lost their meal ticket. And they were not happy about losing their meal ticket. They were really quite angry and brought them, that is, Paul and Silas, to magistrates saying, these men, really being, they are for a fact Jews. I think they were using anti-Semitism to stir up the anger of the magistrate who would then deal with them. They're not Romans. They're not regular folk. Dirty Jews. Why being? Because they're trying to emphasize. They're trying to stress before the magistrate, yes, Paul and Silas really are. And so therefore, they should really be punished bad. That's the difference between any and huparko. Huparko would stress the reality of something. So, when you read in Philippians 2:6, who being, I know in my mind that I'm reading out, when I'm pulling out from that, thinking about that, I am stressing to you that Jesus was continually, really, truly, for a fact, in the form of God. Always that way, before the incarnation. Now, see, some, and it's not a modern day heresy with this, but some of the heretical attacks upon the person of Jesus Christ comes from right here. It doesn't really say it was God. You see, he was only in the form of God. Well, that's not understanding the full meaning of the word form and how words change as they're used over time. But note, before I look at the word form, the prepositional phrase, in the form of God, that's the first thing you see if you're looking at your Greek text in verse 6. And what that does is that tells me that he is stressing this. You can put word order, unlike English, Greek word order can be scrambled any way you want to scramble it. You don't have to have, subject, verb, object. It's not necessary, like in English. You put a direct object before a verb in English, and your English teacher is going to circle that little red marker and tell you, hey, draw an ugly face, an unhappy face. No, it goes here. Not in Greek. You can put word, order, they have, standard order is, just like English. Subject, verb, object. prepositional phrases will follow your verbal. That's standard, but you don't have to use it. And when you don't, when you move something into a different position in the word order than norm, it synthesizes. And that's exactly what he's done here. He is stressing, emphasizing that he really, as to his perpetual state of being, he continually existed in the morphe of God, the form of God. There's the word form, the word morphe. Morphe is only used three times in the New Testament. And I just hate that. Really do. It's used here in verse 6. It's also used in verse 7, which reads, "But made himself in the reputation that took up on himself the form of a servant." So whatever morphe means in verse 6, it's going to mean in verse 7. And that will immediately tell us, well, when he's talking about morphe, he can't be just talking about some kind of outward form, because what kind of forms do servants come in? Slaves in that day, all shapes and sizes. Slaves came as big men, little men, middle-sized men. Slaves came as children. Slaves came as women. It has to mean something different than just a shape of something or form of something in that sense. And so it's only used three times in the New Testament, so we're limited. The other passages I'm going to look to is where Karl Mark. Crud. Mark 16:12. That's the other place where it's used. So that's the only three places you can see the word morphe. So I had to spend a whole lot of time because I wanted to get a feel for the sense of the word, because my lexicons give it form as the first meaning. You use the word form. I get it. But what do you mean when you say form? Let me explain. I'm using an illustration. You have to sometimes explain what you mean by words. I have a pretty eclectic taste in music range. But one of the forms of music I thoroughly enjoy are music from the mid-50s. I love the music. And I caught a song the other day. It was by the Platters. Trust me, my wife will tell you I'm not going to sing it. Okay, so you can relax. I would not do those to those poor gentlemen. But the song was, the title is The Great Pretender. Okay. In that song, there is a verse, part of the lyric that goes like this. Pretending to be happy and gay like a clown, pretending you're still around. Now, when he said gay like a clown, today, anybody under 40 years old, I think I might have to explain that to them. Because if I sit down, I should have done this. If I had time, I would ask Presley. Presley, somebody's gay like a clown. What does that mean? My guess is my granddaughter, she would think for a minute, I didn't know clowns were gay. Because she is going to associate with it something different as to meaning with the word gay than the man or woman, and I don't know who penned that song, The Great Pretender, meant when they used the word gay. You have to understand, that's how you use the word. What did the word mean? So in order to find out what this word morphe meant, I tried to look as many places as I could outside of the New Testament to get a sense for the word. And it really is, outside the New Testament, its primary sense was, and I think it says application here, it was a metaphysical term, a metaphysical philosophical word. Morphe outside of the New Testament was used to deal with, and I hope I put this up here, two fundamental questions. And I owe a great deal, I stuck him up here because I owe a great deal to J.B. Lightfoot. Lightfoot gave me some places to go, sources to look, and find how the word morphe is used. And as I went through those sources, one of the places I ran across was this guy, Parmenides. Parmenides is a philosopher. Little Lola would like him. I like him. Because Parmenides, they call him a Greek philosopher, but he came from Italy. Okay. Two kinds of people in the world, Italians and all the rest of which they were. And this is where Parmenides came from. He came from here in southern Italy, Viale, Italy. This guy now is born way back in about 500 B.C., or not born, 500 B.C., someplace in that area, 500. We have, through antiquity, one of his writings has been preserved. It's a poem. It's On Nature by Parmenides. Now, I was able, Lightfoot gave me the guy's name, I was able to digging around, and I could find this poem of his. Now, we don't have the whole poem. There's portions of it there, fragments of it there, but I can't imagine why somebody would want to spend the time to be a Parmenides scholar. But there are men who do that. So I'm just going to take their word for it. Those Parmenides scholars say this poem originally had about 800 lines to it, 800 verses in it. And again, we have portions of about 160 or so of those verses or portions of those verses that are around. And from his writing, as this word is used, you can begin to pick up the sense that this word, and now I've got to how the New Revised Standard get to nature, and I see how, from this poem. Here's parts. These are verses. Did I mark? I think I put them up at the end. I've forgotten what they are, but I think I stuck them up. This is a small portion of it, like 110 through 125. But nevertheless, here's my word morphe. Men have determined in their minds to have two principles. That's morphe. Okay? Now, the writer, the translator, this piece, want to put literally forms. So, morphe are principles. Now, but one of these they ought not to name, and in so doing have erred. They distinguish them in character. Now, please note that morphe is something that has character, something that has essence. You could use this word, in nature, in essence. And give each of them character, and notice something else that morphe has. Morphe has attributes. That which has morphe, that which has attributes, distinct from those of other. On the one hand, there is the ethereal flame of fire. The ethereal flame of fire is one of these two morphes, okay? So we have one morphe, or principle. One morphe is the flame of fire. Fine, rarefied, everywhere identical with itself, and not identical with its opposite morphe. And on the other, that is the other morphe, the other principle, opposed to the first, is the second principle, and notice the second morphe has character, different than the first, flameless, darkless, dense, and heavy in character. Of these two morphe, these two things which have character, these two things which have essence, declare to thee every arrangement as it appears to men, so that no knowledge among mortals may surpass thine. But since all things are called light and darkness, and the peculiar properties, morphe has properties. And here's another word for properties. Properties are characteristics. Properties can be attributes. Properties can be essence. And the peculiar properties, and they have individual unique properties of these, are predicated of one thing and another. Everything is at the same time full of light and full of obscure darkness. And you can see this guy's a philosopher. How can they be all of that? It makes no sense. Of both equally, since neither has anything in common with the other. The only reason I went to this guy, and by looking at what he was saying, and how all I cared about, I could care less what your philosophy is. I could care less. I do care, when you use the word morphe, what do you mean? A morphe is something that has essence, something that has character, something that has nature. So when you take the word morphe with that sense, now I can go back to Philippians 2. It's okay. The word form, morphe, can denote the nature. It can denote the essence of something. Now I understand why the New Revised Standard Version translators translated exactly as they did. The very nature. That's a good translation. It's a better translation than form because of what we do with the word form today. When you're talking about the form, you're talking about the very essence or the very nature. This is a quote from Lightfoot. He cited Plato himself. I just took it from him. Concerning the word morphe, just trying to understand how is a word used? Why do I want to understand that? Because this is God's word. And what they mean is important, okay? Every single word in this book is important to me to understand. Because all the words I have from Him. And I don't want to misunderstand a word. Because if I misunderstand the word, then we haven't communicated. And I'm trying to communicate. In Plato, we first meet with a clear example of its, that is morphe, he's talking in the context, of morphe's philosophical sense. In Phaedo. Phaedo was Plato's fourth, it was his final writing concerning the death of Socrates. And this is, again, he's citing two verses, 103 and 104 out of that. He goes on to say, Socrates, eliciting the doctrine of ideas by question and answer after his wont or his manner, concludes, Not only is the same name always claimed for the eidos, eidos means external appearance, that which you can see, okay, itself, but also for something which is not the eidos, the external form, and yet has its morphe, always, wherever it exists. So something can have not look the same, but always has the same morphe. Well, what's the morphe? If it's not looking the same, the morphe is not the external form. The same morphe is the essence. The same morphe is the nature. The same morphe is the same character. Thus, in Plato's language, the morphe is always the impress of the idea or the individual, or in other words, the specific character. You could take those two words, plug them into Philippians 2 in verse 5, who being existing with the specific character of God. That's what he means by form. That is what is meant by the word morphe. In Plato, the morphe, that is the character, that is the essence of a thing, remains even if the external shape or form changes. And so the Greek word morphe denotes the specific nature, the essential nature of either something or someone. That is the proper sense of the word in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 6. Who, that is Jesus Christ, always existing, picking up the present tense form of huparko, in the essential nature, essence of God. Now, I don't know how you can be a whole lot clearer concerning the nature of Jesus Christ before the incarnation. His nature was that of God. Always existed with all of the attributes, all of the characteristics of God, because He's God. Let me ask you this question. Who could exist with all of the attributes, all the essence, all the nature of God? Who could do that? Now, God and only God. That's it. Okay? That in itself is statement enough to set forth the absolute truth concerning what I call the absolute deity of Jesus Christ. My friend Richard, I call him my friend. Some of these guys I know better than people are living today because I spend more time with them than other people. But I like Trench. Even though synonyms, he calls it synonyms of the New Testament. He says this about the word morphe. Here's what he writes. Morphe signifies the form as it is the utterance of the inner life. Okay, what is the inner life of Jesus Christ before the incarnation? The inner life was that of deity, absolute deity. Not being, but mode of being, and the last statement is a very good one, or better, mode of existence. What was the mode of existence of Jesus Christ before the incarnation? God. And he makes the same statement. And God, and only God, could have the mode of existence of God. Okay? That's just that's as clear as you can be from the text. I'm going to do something else. See, here he's talking about Jesus existed in the very nature of God. Now, when you talk about form, okay, you also can look, okay, there's outward appearances. Here, I got a lexical statement I'm going to do before I go there. This is by Loanida. Loanida is Greek-English lexical New Testament based on semantic domains. What semantic domains means, when you use those terms, you're talking about words kind of grouped together. Here, here's words with semantic domains. Furniture, okay? Table, chair, what other, bed, those, dresser drawers. All of those words would be in the semantic domain of furniture. And that's all he means. That's all that title means. Now here's what he says. He's looking at this family of words. The nature or character of something, with emphasis upon, and this is what I want to be sure and pick up, both the internal and external form, nature, character. He always had the very nature of God. He always had, and stay with us, he always had the internal nature, character. He always had the external. He always had the external nature of God. Now, external, I'm going to show you that he existed not only with the essence, the nature, the character, but he exists in the external form of God. And this is relatively easy to do. Sooner or later, someday we'll get here. Prior to the incarnation, Jesus Christ's essence, his character, his nature was deity, and his eternal state of being was that of God. And whether I had a passage as clear as Philippians or not, Philippians is stating in dogmatic language. I can pull it together by just conceptually looking at passages of Scripture. This one in John, starting in John 12. 37 through 41. This is a passage that gives us a peek into the pre-incarnate state, the eternal state in which Jesus Christ existed before the Word became flesh. John 12, starting at verse 38, reads, "But though he," that's Jesus, "had done so many miracles before them," the them in this context refers to the Jews that were observing, "yet they believed not on him." I started this far back because I want you to see who the subject is. The subject, he is Jesus. Okay, that's the subject. I'm not going to change subjects as you move through. "That the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who hath believed our report? And to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed?" John 12:38. Now, the verse 39. "Therefore they could not believe, because that Isaiah said again," John 12:39 and 40, "he hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their heart and be converted, and that I should heal them." And to verse 41, "These things said Isaiah when he," that is Isaiah, "saw his glory and spoke of him." Okay? Next verse, make sure you can't miss who he's talking about. "Nevertheless, among the chief rulers also, many believed on him." Who's him here? Jesus Christ, okay? Who is he and who is him here? Jesus Christ. We started at verse 38. I went that far, 37. I went back there so I could show you that we started with Jesus as the subject. And I went one verse beyond. So you see, he is still the subject. So, Isaiah saw Jesus when he said these things. Well, when did he say these things? If we go to Isaiah 6:1, I can show you when he said these things. And we can see in Isaiah 6:1 who Isaiah saw with his own eyes. Isaiah 6:1 says, "In the year that King Uzziah died." Now, you find this kind of formula often in the Old Testament, the year that blank king died. And there's a reason for that formula. The reason is to help us understand this isn't a fairy tale. Okay? He is taking this, I'm going to ground this in time, space, history. This is a real live event. This actually happened. And this is when it occurred. Uzziah died, for what it's worth, sometime around 758, 759 B.C. So that's when these things took place. Now he says, I saw the Lord, Adonai, sitting upon a throne. Isaiah sees the Lord, and how does he see him? He sees him in his kingly state, sitting up on a throne high, lifted up. He is sitting up on the throne, the highest glory possible. He is sitting upon the throne as the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, as the only potentate. That's how he sees him. He sees him sitting on a throne. And it says, and his train filled the temple. Train talks, it's, means skirts. It's would be the long skirts of his long flowing robe. He sees him attired as he is, as the King of Kings, as the Lord of Lords. The whole temple is filled with his immensity. Just fills the whole thing. Now, this Isaiah saw who? Who did John say Isaiah seeing? Who is he seeing? He's seeing Jesus. Okay? That's who he says he's seeing. I'm going on to the next verse. And above it, that is above the throne, stood the seraphim. They're a special class of angels. Each one had six wings, with two he covered his face, probably for a reason. Probably for the same reason that God stuck Moses in the rock and only let his back pass. Because to see the glory of the face of the Lord, more than they could deal with. It would be so overwhelming. Probably the glory of the Lord would have killed them. Patricia told me, and I just, what an idiot. And I shouldn't call somebody an idiot. What an idiotic statement, that's better. She heard somebody ask Robert De Niro. I'm going to embarrass my race, Robert, or my ethnic group. She asked Robert De Niro, should you get to the pearly gates, what are you going to say to God? Here's what he thinks he's going to say. Trust me, he's not going to. But he thinks he's going to say, you got a lot of explaining to do. A lot of explaining to do. Here is a man like most people today who have no concept, none, of the glory, of the holiness, of the righteousness, of the awesomeness of God Almighty. Because should he get to the pearly gates, his face will be face down. That's why they cover their face. The two he covered his feet, the two he did fly. And now move to verse 3. And one cried to another. When he says one cried to another, this is anaphoric. This would be like we used to do when I went to football games. Arrowhead Stadium's a great place to go watch a football game in Kansas City. Enormous, 78,000 people. And you could get people on, how do we face east and west? You could get the people on the east. And we did this with the east and the north end zone, and then with the west and the south end zone. And you would, the east would yell out one chant, the west would yell back. And so you would yell back and forth, back and forth. And that's what you have here. That's what anaphoric means. You have angels on one side crying out, holy, holy, holy. Then you have angels on the other side crying back, holy, holy, holy. And it doesn't stop. This continual proclamation and praise of the holiness of God is, now here's, and I should have made this word differently, remember who's on the throne, is Yahweh, not Adonai, but now he goes, is Yahweh, the one exclusive name reserved for God and for God alone, host of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. And the post of the door moved at the voice of him who cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Smoke just figuratively probably here denoting the fullness of the presence of God. In His holiness permeated the whole place, which is why, and I don't have the verse cited, I didn't think it went down far enough, but verse 5, which Isaiah says, "Woe is unto me, I'm a dead man." Why? Because I have unclean lips. I'm a sinful man. And my eyes have seen the holiness of God. Who did he see? He saw Jesus sitting upon the throne of glory. How he saw Jesus in his morphe, using the external sense of that word. He saw Jesus Christ as he exists in his pre-incarnate state as a very God with all the essence, attributes, characteristics of God, and the position of God with all of its attendant glory. That's how he saw him in his eternal state. Here. Come from another direction. How did he exist prior to the incarnation? As the very God of very God. "And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had." I had is an imperfect tense form. The imperfect tense goes to go to past. Time of action is past. Well, how far past? Well, do I need to go before the world was? So before the world was, that's where I start my past. And then the imperfect tense is continual action. So constantly, continually, before the world was ever created, I had this glory. What glory? The glory that he had with the Father. Why wouldn't he have the same glory as the Father? Because he's God. He is the very God of very God. I wish we did know this. If you knew that, then maybe the guy today would have been so worried about getting you baptized that Pat listened to on the radio or TV about salvation. For you know the grace, the unmerited favor, the undeserved, unearned, unrecompensable favor of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, the Greek word for rich is where we get our word plutocrat from. It means you're talking about someone that is just filthy rich, okay? You're talking about somebody just the money running out the ears kind of rich. You're talking about Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, George Soros. These guys combining it all together. Kind of money rich. Just rich beyond imagination. See, Christ was rich beyond imagination. When was that? When he was working in the carpenter shop with Joseph? Don't think so. Or when he said, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. I don't have a place to lay my head. Obviously, when he says he was rich, that was prior to the incarnation. "Yet for your sakes he became poor." That's became incarnate. Why would he do that? Why would he leave heaven? Why would he take upon himself the form of a man? Why would he place all those limitations on himself? That ye through his poverty, ye might become rich. And we are in Christ Jesus. He hath blessed you with every blessing in the heavenlies. We are rich beyond imagination spiritually. All made possible. Because he became poor. He became a man. Who being in the form thought it not robbery to be equal with God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, something to be exploited. The one who continually, constantly existed in the exalted state of glory with all of the attributes, all of the essence, all of the prerogatives, all of the power of God, didn't think, no, robbery, was the other one, a thing to be grasped, something to be exploited. Those, that's the next word. I'll take the word to be.
to be equal with God, to be, that's the present infinitive of the state of verb, I me. Now it goes to basic verb. It's already used on, this is really the case. So I can go ahead and say, in a normal state, to be, continually, constantly, that's the essence of that present tense, always, forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. When that forever runs out, some more forever. He continually was equal with God. Which means he's pointing to the continuing nature of the state of being. Of being equal. Equal, his thought, to be the same. And I mean to be the same. He is the same as God. He has the same character, the same essence, the same nature, the same attributes. He has the same position, the same glory. All of that was His. All of that equal. And then let me put equal into something that fits the context. In this context, when He talks about being equal with God, He's talking about all prerogatives. All of His prerogatives as God. That's what we're looking at in this passage. In His pre-incarnate state, He continually existed, having the same rights as God. All the prerogatives, all of the things which belong to God and God alone, belong to Jesus Christ in His pre-incarnate state. He had the right to do all the things that God could do. He had the right to receive everything that God could receive. He had equality with the Father. When He says, who being in the form of God and being equal with God, these are very strong. These are absolutely dogmatic statements declaring the deity of Jesus Christ. And He is declaring it as just this, in the most absolute sense possible. Now the last thing in verse 6, thought it not robbery, did not regard it a thing to be grasped, did not regard it as something to be exploited. Let me take just a second with the word regard, and I'm not sure if I stuck it up here. It's hegelmai. Did I not? Yeah, I did. Hegelmai means to engage in an intellectual process. Now, the verb hegelmai means that He gave careful. He gave deliberative thought. He gave diligent thought. And then He came to a conclusion. This was not a knee-jerk emotional response on the part of the Word. He didn't all of a sudden become emotionally overwhelmed by the plight of man. He thought this through very carefully. You kind of get the picture in mind. I'm sure you didn't do this. My picture in mind, I'm thinking something very carefully. I have my pros and I have my cons. And I start writing them down. Well, if I do that, that's good. Then I look at my pros and my cons. And then I make a decision. That's hegelmai. He gave very careful, thoughtful, deliberative weighing of what was before him. What was before him is, do I hold on to my position, my status, my prestige, my power as God or not? That's a decision. And he thought about that decision. And he came to a conclusion. And the conclusion that he came to is expressed by the word robbery, the word grasped, or the word exploited, apogmas. That's the conclusion he came to. Boy, this is a rare word. It's not found again in the New Testament. It's not found in the Septuagint. And I hate that because that means you're forced. It just takes more time. But you then have to look at what kind of senses or meanings do lexicons give to the word apogmas. Here is a literal translation of the word, a definition of the word from the Greek English lexicon, New Testament, and other early Christian literature. It means a violent seizure of property, robbery. Well, that's the first sense of the word. So King James gave it the first meaning, robbery. As equal to pagma, that's a noun form, something to which one can claim or assert title by gripping or grasping. Something claimed. And so now I see we're a New American Standard. Okay, there's something to be held on to, something to be grasped. Loanida, again, here's what they do with the word. That which is to be held on to by force. Something to be forcibly retained. Basically, and I have probably 8 or 9 different lexicons. I went through all my different lexicons, and when I got through, you could pretty much what they have boiled the word down to, and they did this the way they do this, same way I do it. Okay, they do this exact same thing I do with words. You're in order to get a meaning for a word, a lexicographer, what he does is he finds. In this case, with these languages, you find these words in other writings, and you read the writings. And if you read enough writings, you know what all the other words mean. You take out the word, in this particular case, you pull out the word hapagmos. You sit that word aside and say, okay, I don't know what it means. But I'm going to read all these other things where the word is used, and I know all the meanings of other words, and see if I can't figure it out. I've done this before with you, but let me do it again because it illustrates it pretty well. I'm going to make up a word, and I'm going to give you other words that you'll know what the meaning is, and you'll figure out the meaning of the word that I have in my mind, which is gizzergaps. Okay? Good. You've never heard the word gizzergaps. Okay, let's say they never heard the word harpagmos, and you can't look in the New Testament for it, so you start reading outside the New Testament. Okay, gizzergaps are something that I have trouble keeping track of anymore. I have to be very careful when I get home at night that I put my gizzergaps in the exact same place every time. Because if I don't put the gizzergaps in the exact same place every time, tomorrow morning when I get up and go to work and I jump in my truck and reach in my pocket for my gizzergap so I can start the truck, what's a gizzergap? Yeah, okay. That's how they determine the meaning of the word. It is simply read enough literature outside. In this case, they have plenty to read. Okay? And here's their conclusion. You can take their conclusion and draw it down to here. Something to grasp after or something to hold on to. Okay? And that's when you take all of the variable places you see, you can just break it down in a concise Greek English lexicon dictionary. The New Testament did a good job. So these are the two alternatives that you apply to the word. Either it's something to grasp after or it's something to hold on to. Well, this isn't hard to figure out. Not in the context. Because in the context, he's talking about his equality with God. He already had it. He possessed that forever. So to grasp after, and that's kind of what you do in robbery, you know, grasp after something, you take off running, you're snatching a purse. No, it's not grasping after, it's holding on to. Holding on to. And that is, I think, the proper sense of the word in the context of Philippians 2:6. In this context, to be held on to. He did not, after giving careful, deliberative thought to, he came to the conclusion that he did not have to hold on to, he did not have to tightly grasp so as not to let go of his equality with God. That's the sense. There's another reason why I think that held on to is probably makes, I don't know how they came up to exploit it. That translation bothers me. And it bothers me for this reason. Because I do not believe that God would ever exploit any of his attributes or essence. Ever. I just don't think he would do that. And it doesn't fit with the totality of the nature of the character of God. How can I be sure that God will never misuse his omnipotent power in a wrongful, evil way? Because God's righteous, right? Righteousness will control that. So I don't like exploiters at all. I don't even know how they got there from that sense. But the context of verse 6 to held on to makes it pretty obvious to me, and verse 7 clearly makes it obvious to me that's the meaning. He did not think he had to grasp, hold up, continue to grasp hold of, feel or was grasping hold of it, his equality with God. But instead of holding on to equality with God, here's what he did. But made himself of no reputation. The word but is this is the strong word for but in Greek. This is really a sharp contrast. Very radical. It is something radically different to clinging to not letting go of his equality with God. Instead of doing that, he made himself of no reputation, whatever that might mean, and taking upon himself the form of a servant and being made in the likeness of men. I think the best interpretation of the word harpagmos in this context is to hold on to. And Dr. Robertson, in his Word Pictures commentary, says this about our verse. This is to say, Paul means a prize to be held on to be held on to, rather than something to be won. Lightfoot puts it this way: "Uk harpagmon higasata," which is not consider to be held on to, "yet did not regard it as a prize, a treasure to be clutched and to retain at all hazards, though he continually existed in the essential essence, nature of God. He did not think equality with God was something he had to clutch tightly to." Let this thinking be in you. Wow. Now to verse 7. "But made himself of no reputation, and took up on him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men." When you're at verse 6, you're dealing with the attitude. Okay? The attitude, the mindset of the pre-existent Christ. When we get down to verse 7, what we're now dealing with, from verses 7 and 8, you're moving from attitude to actions. You're going to see the actions that flow from that attitude, which is something, again, you wish you could get across to all Christians. Not outward conduct. What's outward conduct flow from? Is our conduct flowing from a right mindset? Is our conduct flowing? Is our obedience flowing from truth and love? Lord, attitude to actions in his post-incarnate state. See, verses 7 and 8, which obviously I'm going to finish. I'll finish both of these by next week. The post-incarnate state of Christ. The pre-incarnate state establishes his deity. Okay? It's his, always has been his. Never stops being his. Now, the post-incarnate state, we're looking at his in his humanity. "But made himself of no reputation, took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of man," verse 7. Verse 8, "and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of a cross." First point. Please understand this was of his own choosing. The Godhead did not meet and have a vote of two to one. You're going to go do this. We didn't have the tyranny of the majority, which is a concept people just can't do. People of this nation better wake up to that concept of the tyranny of the majority, particularly if you're a believer. People who are Democrats, thank God we're not a Democratic country. We're a Democratic Republic. And thank you, there's a difference. You've got to be careful about majority. Well, majority rules, what do we want, really? I tried this one. I did this and I got, boy, did I get in trouble. I probably should have used a better illustration, but I was a pretty brass, and my wife can tell you, somewhat arrogant young man in college, and I was dealing with this in college with the professor and trying to get a point across about the tyranny majority. And so, okay, you think majority rules are great. Okay, here we go. And I just found a class with women. Okay, we have 5 women and we have 10 men in our society. We have a vote. Should women be raped or not raped? The men vote 9, yay, 1, nay. The women vote 5, nay, with the 1, yay, 9-6 majority rules. That's what I mean by the tyranny of the majority.
Okay?
It is something to be careful of, to be aware of. He was not forced into this. It wasn't the tyranny of the majority in the Godhead. He voluntarily chose to do this. It was his own choosing. Stated very clearly, but made himself. Following the but is the pronoun hatan. Hatan is a reflexive pronoun. He did it. He did it. The one who had all of the prerogatives, the position, the prestige of God, he himself. So it's voluntary of his own choosing. No one forced him to do this. Of no reputation. Emptied himself. Nothing. Those are the translations I have seen for the word kenao. Sometimes you'll hear a theologian talking about the kenesis. Kenesis is the noun form of this verb, kenao. It literally means to empty, so the contents are gone. That's literally what the word means. It's used four more times in the New Testament. The four times are Romans 4:14, 1 Corinthians 1:17, 1 Corinthians 9:15, 2 Corinthians 9:3. It's never used in a literal sense in the New Testament, setting this passage aside. And therefore, I don't believe it's used literally here. Biblical scholars, students for centuries have debated, contemplated, argued about the meaning of he emptied himself. The reason is, if you look at the verse carefully, it doesn't tell you what he emptied himself of. It only says that he did it. Okay? Just says he did it. It cannot mean, and it cannot mean, as some have suggested, it cannot mean that he emptied himself of his divine attributes. Why can't it mean that? Because that means that his essence would have changed. And he is immutable. Cannot change. So it can't mean that he emptied himself of his divine attributes. Anybody gives it in that sense, that explanation is not a good explanation. I'm not even sure emptied is the best translation for kanao in this verse. Here, the word kanao is used in the New Testament with the sense of rendering something void. To render something of no effect. Now, I can have something and I can choose to render it of no effect and not lose it. Okay? That's possible for anybody. You can possess something, have something, and choose to render it of no effect. Passages, all of those passages, Romans 4:14, 1 Corinthians 1:17, 9:15, and 2 Corinthians 9:3, this is basically the sense you're going to see of the word. Either to render something void or of no effect. I've got time maybe to look at a passage or two of them. For if they who are of the law be heirs, they who are of the law. If those who think that by keeping the law, if they are right, so by keeping the law, then I can be heirs, then I can be saved, then faith is made kenao. Well, it's not emptied out. Then faith is rendered null and void. Faith is of no effect. You don't need it. It's made no effect, and the promise of no effect, Romans 4:14. That's kanao. Here's another. For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross should be made kanao, of no effect. The cross isn't emptied, but if salvation is some other way, including if it's by means of baptism, if it's by means of anything else other than the cross, then the cross itself is no effect. It's no effect. That is a good sense for the word kanao, and probably a pretty good sense for the word in, as it's used in Philippians chapter 2, verse 7. But he made himself of no effect. Well, this now gives rise to another question. And here's the other question. Let's wait. What of himself did he make of no effect? What was it? And the answer next Sunday. We'll see what you made yourself of no effect. We'll stop here because I don't have enough time to finish it properly. Relative to what we did get through, any questions?